Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine shots. So far, more than 10.55 million people have been given the first doses and 7.41 million were given the second. Turkey's announcement of a nationwide lockdown during the holy month of Ramadan has created chaos, which is seen by many as the reason behind the increasing number of daily infections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Researchers are searching for possible links between blood clotting and the Oxford AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Heidi Ledford, researcher. This article is titled, How Could Oxford AstraZeneca Vaccine Cause Blood Clots? Scientists race to investigate. Stay tuned for more. The occurrence of a mysterious blood clotting disorder among some recipients of the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine has researchers scrambling to uncover whether and how the inoculation could trigger such a reaction. After weeks of investigation, the European Medicines Agency, EMA, announced on April 7th that there is a possible link between the clots and the vaccine. The finding leaves researchers wrestling with a medical mystery. Why would a vaccine trigger such an unusual condition? Of course, there are hypotheses. Maybe it's something with the vector. Maybe it's an additive in the vaccine. Maybe it's something in the production process. I don't know, says Sabine Eichinger, a hematologist at the Medical University of Vienna. It could be any of these things. He was among the first to notice the clotting disorder, a strange combination of blood clots, which can be dangerous and potentially fatal if they block blood flow to the brain or lungs, and a counterintuitive deficiency of cell fragments called platelets that promote clotting. The clots also appeared in unusual parts of the body, such as the brain and abdomen, rather than in the legs, where most deep vein blood clots form. These alarm bells for doctors who had previously encountered a similar phenomena in a few people who had been treated with the blood-thinning drug heparin. Heparin is normally used to prevent clotting, but in very rare cases can trigger a syndrome called HIT, which causes blood clots together with low platelet levels. By March 22nd, the EMA had assembled 86 reports of people who had experienced blood clots in the brain or abdomen within 2 weeks of receiving a dose of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine developed in Britain by AstraZeneca in Cambridge and the University of Oxford. Some of these cases have been confirmed to bear the hallmarks of HIT, even though these people had not received heparin. The EMA is asking AstraZeneca to conduct a number of investigations, including lab studies, to determine the effect of the vaccine on blood clotting and evaluations of data from clinical trials to try to glean any further information about risk factors, although there are reports that the syndrome is seen more often in women than in men, particularly those aged under 60. The EMA was unable to conclude that women are at higher risk. Many countries prioritize healthcare workers to receive the inoculations, and women comprise a larger segment of this workforce. The EMA is also supporting studies by two academic consortia centered in the Netherlands, one led by Erasmus University Medical Center in Rotterdam, and the other by investigators at Utrecht University and the University Medical Center, Utrecht. Their project list is ambitious. The consortium, co-chaired by virologist Eric C. M. Van Gorp at Erasmus, consists of 22 hospitals that have been working together to study the effects of coronavirus on blood coagulation. The team will look for potential cases of HIT among cases of blood clots following vaccination with the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine and other COVID-19 vaccines. It will also conduct lab studies to look for signs that the already small risk could be cut even further by reducing the amount of vaccine administered in each dose. The EMA expects to obtain some results from the projects within the next 2 months, said Peter Arlett, head of the agency's Data Analytics and Methods Task Force. The team will also try to tease apart whether this problem is restricted to certain populations. What we find in Western Europe will not automatically be true in South America or other populations, says Van Gorp. This is a worldwide problem. Everyone is concerned. And critically, Van Gorp and his colleagues will try to further evaluate whether the probable association between the vaccine and the syndrome is real. It is notoriously difficult to confirm whether a suspected effect of a vaccine is truly linked to the vaccine, partially when it is a vaccine that has been used in tens of millions of people. Somebody who gets the vaccine could have a stroke or a heart attack a week later because they were already going to have a stroke or a heart attack, says cardiologist Manoj Bikdeli at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Victor Lee would also like to see researchers collect and share more data about the incidence of this clotting condition in unvaccinated populations. Heightened awareness around the possible link between vaccination and the syndrome could lead to increased reporting rates among those who are vaccinated compared with those who are not, which could falsely inflate the perceived rate at which the syndrome occurs, he says. And such concerns could spread to other coronavirus vaccines. Other researchers are keen to pick apart what triggers the syndrome. HIT is thought to be the result of an immune reaction to complexes formed when negatively charged heparin molecules bind to a positively charged protein called platelet factor 4, which is important for clotting. The result is activation of platelets kicking off a chain reaction. Once you get the platelets activated, it's like putting a match to tinder, says John Kelton, a hematologist at McMaster University in Hamilton, Canada, who has been studying HIT for 40 years.
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kovat Ahway. Iran's Natanz nuclear plant has been hit. A small explosion in what Iran has labeled as an Israeli act of terrorism. Nuclear terrorism, to be exact. And the timing could not be more suspicious in more ways than one. First, this happened on the week which was Iran's Nuclear Technology Week. Then it happened during the nuclear talks in Vienna between Iran and the world powers, minus the U.S. And third, it happened when the U.S. Defense Secretary was visiting Israel. Israel's act of sabotage and nuclear terrorism against Iran, the subject of this edition of the debate.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility. But the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer Scott Witter, joins us from Bethlehem in New York. We also have political analyst Said Mustafa Hoshesh, who joins us. Gentlemen, welcome. Scott Witter, let me first start with you and get your reaction about what has happened. The Natanz uranium enrichment plant, where an act of terror has hit the plant's electricity distribution. What do you think about what has occurred?
First of all, we know it wasn't an act. This was a deliberate act, and the timing appears to have been deliberate, which means it was a well-planned attack, which means that the perpetrators of this attack, most likely Israeli intelligence, had goals and objectives that went beyond simply inflicting damage, which would have a political aspect attached to them. And I think, Iran has pretty much, done what the Israelis wanted it to do. Iran has condemned it, rightly so. Israel knew Iran would condemn it. But Iran, more importantly, from the Israeli perspective, has made a commitment to replace the damaged or destroyed IR-1 centrifuges, which are the only centrifuges currently allowed to operate in Iran under the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action, and replace them with more advanced designs. And this, I believe, is what the Israeli objective was all along, for Iran to commit to continued installation and operation of designs that are incompatible with its obligations under the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action. Yes, Iran says we are committed to do so under Article 26 of the agreement, which says that if the United States lifts nuclear sanctions, Iran can do away with its obligations. But Iran has said that every action it takes under Article 26 will be immediately reversible. I believe that Iran's commitment to install more advanced centrifuges, not only in Natanz, but to transfer the centrifuge enrichment capability from Natanz to the Fordow underground nuclear facility, represents a more permanent action, which will be difficult to rectify in light of its ongoing negotiations with the United States. And this was the purpose of the Israeli attack, to undermine the negotiations currently taking place between Iran and the United States about the Americans rejoining the JCPOA, lifting sanctions, and bringing everything back into compliance with the original intent of the agreement.
Okay. Mustafa Hoshesh, Iran has accused Israel of carrying out this act of nuclear terrorism. Do you think Israel is guilty?
Israel is definitely guilty. Let's remember that in similar cases in the past, they always pursued the policy of ambiguity. But in the last three cases, starting from a similar attack on a centrifuge hull at Natanz months ago, they have reduced ambiguity to, take the responsibility one way or another through the U.S. media outlets like New York Times reports, where they quoted unnamed U.S. officials saying that the U.S. is clean of such actions, and they pointed the finger at Israel. There is no other regime in the world to enjoy an attack on a civilian, nuclear civilian facility except for Israel. And of course, let's remember that they have been emboldened enough to acclaim and to be proud of what they've done. When they assassinated the Iranian civilian nuclear scientist, Dr. Fakhrizadeh, they couldn't hide that they were happy with that, and they took some kind of pride in saying that they have the power to assassinate civilians. But let me point out that I disagree with your other guest I do believe that this has been a joint venture by the United States and Israel. The Americans are the main beneficiary of this action and similar actions in the past. It's nothing new. We have already experienced it in the past decade before the JCPOA talks. This is part of the United States' carrot and stick policy in order to push Tehran to the talks through increasing the costs and increasing the pressures. This is part of actually the maximum pressure policy that's still being pursued by the U.S. administration of Joe Biden.
I'm sorry to jump in, but hold on to your thoughts. Let me get a reaction then, if that's what you're disagreeing on with Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter, our guest there, says that this is something that both Israel and the U.S. cooperatively have executed, and the U.S. is a beneficiary in this case because it will want to pressure Iran to, have flexibility in the talks to get Iran to accept whatever it is that the U.S. wants. Do you see it that way?
Possible. Look, the United States is the world's worst negotiating partner. If I were the Iranians, I wouldn't believe a thing the United States said. I'm giving my country the benefit of the doubt. Because right now, no evidence exists that links the United States, complicit in this attack. But the fact of the matter is, Israel and the United States are joined at the hip policy-wise. We have shared interactions on the intelligence side of the house, the defense side of the house, the policy side of the house, and the likelihood of Israel carrying out an attack of this magnitude on Iran with this timing, without anybody in the Biden administration knowing about it in advance, is slim to none. So it's indeed possible, maybe even likely, that the United States and Israel were coordinating together on this. But the United States has to distance itself, because to come out and publicly acknowledge that there was an American role would destroy all confidence, not only on the part of Iran, which would have every right to be enraged by this act of nuclear terrorism, by somebody who wants to rejoin as a party to the Iran nuclear agreement, but also all the members of the JCPOA, Russia, China, France, Germany, Great Britain, the United, the European Union, should all be outraged, not only by what Israel has done, but if the United States was complicit in this, with what the United States has done. It's totally incompatible with the spirit, letter, and intent of the negotiations that are ongoing in Vienna. So, I don't reject what he said. I acknowledge that it's a likelihood. There's no evidence of it right now, but logic dictates that the other gentleman is probably correct.
Well, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, the U.S. Has come out and made a statement on this. It has said that it was not involved in any attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear site, and has, and this is the interesting part, and has no comment on speculation about the cause of the incident. The question is that the actual truth? Our guest says that U.S. does not speak an ounce of truth when it comes to certain things. And how could this not have involved the U.S., especially when you have the U.S. Defense Secretary in Israel when this happened, not only having conversations with his counterpart, but also the latest to have been with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Let me raise the case like this. Ever since Trump took office, maybe a few months after he took office, he was accusing John Kerry that he was sending pulses to Iran to avoid business with Donald Trump and wait for a Democrat administration. True or not, when Joe Biden started his campaign, he started talking about Iran deal, that he is very much up for reviving the nuclear deal, that he would definitely get back to the nuclear deal. He talked to the CNN, and he published actually a manifesto with regard to Iran. He was very much expressive about Iran policy and the nuclear deal. But as soon as he took office, he started talking about Iran, pretending that China and Russia and domestic problems like COVID-19 were his priorities. So this reloquence, it was meant to push Iran to give up its leverages. They said that if Iran is willing to revive the deal, then Tehran could, give up its modified actions under the deal and resume its obligations. Why? Because they wanted Iran to give up its leverages. But Tehran, the Iranian top supreme leader, said that Iran is in no rush. Then the Iranian parliament approved the bill, a law, that included four leverages against the U.S. Three of them were of a nature of urgency and emergency as far as leverage on Biden was concerned. One was a halt of implementing the additional protocol to the NPT. But of course, Iran and the IAEA struck a deal to extend it for 3 months one way or another. This move actually lost its urgency. There remain two others. That was one, the enrichment to the 20% purity level. Second, Iran working on highly advanced centrifuge machines. It was then that Biden offered Tehran a deal, a partial deal, they called it preparatory steps, to stop these two leverages in return for releasing part of Iran's frozen funds or all of the funds that have been frozen and removal of a number of sanctions. Iran rejected it outright, immediately. Then we can see they came for attack on Natanz. And let's remember, the last year attack on Natanz was also on a hall that was assembling, where they assembled highly advanced centrifuge machines. And let's remember that Joe Biden, who was reluctant to talk even about Iran, 2 weeks ago, in a sudden change of heart, under these leverages, these two moves and actions, in a sudden change of heart, he called his administration into immediate sessions and meetings to wrap up a policy on Iran. And then they called for talks with Iran. They pressured Europeans to summon Tehran to talks in Vienna, and they've been pressuring Iran for talks. So they have been doing anything and everything to take away these two leverages, hoping that Iran would soften its tone after it loses these two leverages and would agree with the U.S. Okay. to a partial removal of sanctions and direct talks with the United States. One more point, and I wrap it up. One other purpose of this is that once you stop Iran's leverages and undermine Iran's power and hand in such confrontation with the U.S. over the JCPOA, then there will be marathon talks. That's one of the purposes of the United States. They want to lengthen the duration of the talks, hoping that they could wear off Iran's resolve through marathon talks.
Okay, well, Scott Ritter, first of all, this needs to be addressed by you. Do you think that what has happened is going to affect the talks that are happening in Vienna? And if so, how?
Good. I mean, it could. I happen to believe that the Biden administration is desperate to bring an end to the crisis around the JCPOA at this time. It recognizes several realities, one of which is that Iran is about to have a national election in which a new presidential administration will be brought in, one that's more than likely far more conservative than the present administration of Hassan Rouhani, and one that will be more in concert with the position of the Iranian parliament when it comes to Iran's nuclear program and international attempts to curtail it. So there's a window of opportunity to strike, and they want to strike. The other issue is there's a domestic imperative. You know, the United States has created this artificial notion of a breakout window, the one-year breakout time. The entire Joint Comprehensive Program of Action is built around that, constraining Iran's nuclear program so that if it decided to stop cooperating, it would take them 1 year to enrich enough uranium to produce a single fissile weapon, a nuclear weapon. And that would give the United States enough time to come up with a counter, whether military, diplomatic, or a combination thereof. Right now, Iran has blown past that one-year mark. In fact, if Iran continues to install advanced centrifuges, this breakout window, which is an artificial construct, it doesn't exist except in the minds of American politicians. But that's the dangerous thing, that the American politicians in Congress and in the White House are convinced that Iran will be able to produce a bomb rapidly, and that the best hope is to get the JCPOA back in play. But remember this. The United States never intended to allow the JCPOA to reach its endgame state, meaning that at some point under the JCPOA, all restrictions would be lifted and Iran would be allowed unrestricted enrichment under Article 4 of the Nonproliferation Treaty. with, you know, without constraints, as long as it's for peaceful purposes. That will never happen. The United States will never let that happen. Barack Obama said as much. He said, we're just buying 13, 14, 15-year time, and then we'll deal with this down the road. If Iran continues to insist on wanting to enrich, we'll have to come up with a way to stop it. And that's the policy of the Biden administration. So even if they're able to navigate these troubled diplomatic waters and come up with an arrangement with Iran that allows the JCPOA to come back into full force, Iran should not, you know, pretend or mislead itself into thinking the United States is just going to walk away and say, that's it, the JCPOA is done. Oh, American policy has been and will always be to deny Iran the ability to have unrestricted enrichment of uranium.
Okay, final question to you, Samasanaba. I'm sorry, Khoshchesh, apologize for that. Where do you see the talks going? How has this affected it? If you can do that in about 2 minutes' time.
I believe that if the move with the goals that I just said in mind, the Israelis and Americans, this has been a joint venture to soften Iran's tone, to weaken Iran's stance, but I believe it would backfire. Iran would definitely do a number of reciprocal actions. First and foremost, I believe Tehran's stance would remain tough, and they would even toughen their tone. There are calls in Tehran already to call for a halt or stop or ending any kind of talks in Vienna until the world powers, the IAEA and others, take action against Israel and do their duty, or do something for world peace and security. Otherwise, Iran would have the, you know, right, would be entitled to the right to retaliate, and this would escalate tensions. Therefore, the world powers and the IAEA are duty bound to take action against this act of terrorism, nuclear terrorism. And in addition to toughening tone, I believe, by Tehran, if they continue the talks in Vienna, they would toughen tone, and after that, maybe after a few months, we would see Iran's reciprocal action one way or another, through cyber attack or through the military or whatever, because if they don't stop the Israeli atrocities, let's remember that this could have happened a day earlier when Iranian officials were visiting the facility, and this could have killed them, you know. This could have killed the Iranian experts and politicians, as well as nuclear scientists in there. This could have wreaked havoc on the environment by radioactive pollution. Therefore, Tehran would definitely make Israel and the United States pay for that. Otherwise, they would be emboldened to scale up and to enhance their threats and widen their threats to Iran.
Okay, I do have more time here. So, Scott Ritter, I'm going to ask you something that you mentioned about the centrifuges. Now, we have had the Atomic Energy Organization head, Dr. Adiak Rasala, is saying that the damaged centrifuges, and I'm quoting him, will be replaced with even more powerful ones. You talked about how that puts Iran on a path of it being irreversible, if I heard you correctly, if you can expand on that a little bit more, because Iran has always said that it can reverse the actions that it is taking when it comes to its nuclear program in terms of the way forward that it is going with it.
Well, there's a couple things. Not only did they say that they're going to replace the damaged IR-1 centrifuges with more advanced designs, but they also spoke of transferring enrichment capability out of Natanz into the Fordo underground facility, which is a much more difficult target for Israel, the United States, or anybody else who wants to physically interdict Iran's enrichment capability. This is impermissible under the JCPOA. And, you know, if for Iran to live up to its obligation to reverse everything that it has done citing Article 26 of the JCPOA, Iran would have to be willing to transfer everything out of Fordo back to Natanz, decommission all of these new centrifuges. I'm not saying that's impossible, but I'm saying that it makes things much more difficult for Iran to reach compliance with its obligation to reverse the measures undertaken under Article 26. And I think that's what Israel intended. I think Israel intended to compel Iran to escalate its enrichment activities in a manner that are incompatible with the JCPOA, thereby complicating the negotiations in Vienna. Whether Israel did this in concert with the United States or independent of the United States, only history will be able to tell. But this is a deliberate effort on the part of Israel, most likely some elements within the Biden administration, to sabotage the negotiations that are taking place in Vienna right now.
Okay, very well. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter there. And thank you, political analyst Seyed Mostafa Khoshchesh. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tahlis, goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The significance of the presidency as the heaviest managerial responsibility of the country.
The second issue is about the significance of the presidency. The presidency is a very important issue. The most important and influential managerial responsibility is the presidency. Now, some people claim that the president has no authority, that he is a mere caterer, and that he has just 12-15% authority. I do not know how they calculate these things. It is several years now that they have been saying these things here and there, but all of them are untrue. These statements are made either out of lack of responsibility or out of ignorance, or God forbid, with ulterior motives. This is not the case. The presidency is one of the heaviest and most demanding responsibilities. To be exact, it is not one of the heaviest, rather it is the heaviest managerial responsibility in the country. Almost all managerial centers of the country are at the disposal of the president. The judiciary branch and military organizations have certain managerial responsibilities as well, but compared to the ones in the executive branch, their managerial responsibilities amount to a few percent above zero.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Almost all managerial responsibilities, thousands of responsibilities, are at the disposal of the head of the executive branch. The entire ratified budget of the country is at the disposal of the president. This is because the head of the planning and budget organization of the country is a vice president, and therefore it is directly supervised by the presidency. The same is true of the country's governmental resources. Most of such resources are at the disposal of the president. Therefore, the other managerial responsibilities at the periphery of the executive branch are really insignificant. The presidency has such an important status. Now, you want to elect a president? Therefore, notice what important responsibility falls on us voters. Of course, my vote is as significant as the vote of a 17-18-year-old boy. It is neither more nor less important than his. We want to go and choose a president, and therefore, we should know what an important responsibility falls on the president. This is another important point.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden might not be building a physical border wall, but he is continuing to expand an infrastructure designed to deter migrants from crossing into the United States. Though he has distanced himself from former President Donald Trump's immigration policy, the Biden administration's plan would see the U.S. government lean into its reliance on technology at the southern border with Mexico, where Customs and Border Protection, CBP, is currently expanding one of the most ambitious surveillance systems ever created. Stay with us for part two of a three-part article written by Will Lennon, under the heading, U.S. Customs and Border Protection Plans Vast Expansion of Technology-Based Surveillance. The article has been taken from truthout.org website. The U.S. federal government is prepared to spend plenty of money on companies willing to work at the southern border with Mexico. Over the past 40 years, the border security budget has grown steadily, from $350 million in 1980 to over $23 billion by 2018. Competition for the funding is fierce. In 2020, 1,452 lobbyists worked on homeland security issues in Washington. 1,390 lobbyists worked on immigration. Anduril Industries has shelled out over $1 million to a lobbying firm called Invariant since 2017. They successfully lobbied Congress to expand the deployment of Anduril Industries' surveillance tower program, and in July 2020, the surveillance towers were declared a program of record. CBP, Customs and Border Protection, already has 60 towers at this point. They aim to have 200 by 2022. In the summer of 2020, Anduril Industries started a contract with Department of Homeland Security worth more than $60 million. The product service code for the contract reads, Construction of Electronic and Communications Facilities. The agreement is an indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, or IDIQ contract, meaning Department of Homeland Security placed a preliminary baseline order and will have the opportunity to re-up annually until summer of 2025. IDIQ contract could ultimately be worth up to nearly $250 million and yield 170 surveillance towers for customs and border protection. The two smaller contracts that fall under the IDIQ are for prefabricated tower structures. The first surveillance tower contract has a start date in July of 2020. It shows 37 land surveillance towers and 3 maritime surveillance towers due to be delivered within a year. The second surveillance tower contract is dated September 2020 and consists of 76 surveillance towers along with replacement parts to be delivered within the year. A statement of work says Anduril Industries relies on Amazon Web Service, AWS, to centrally manage application and user access. Anduril Industries is identified in these documents as a small business. Palmer Luckey, one of Anduril Industries' co-founders, is an expert in sensor fusion from his days working in virtual reality. He previously founded the virtual reality gaming company Oculus, where he used sensor fusion to track players' movements, combining data from magnetometers, accelerometers, and gyroscopes. According to Palmer Luckey, Anduril Industries' surveillance towers use sensor fusion and artificial intelligence to create a three-dimensional model of large battle spaces. The surveillance towers combine data from radar, visual imaging, and thermal measurements. According to Customs and Border Protection, the towers can also communicate with each other, performing handoffs when something passes from the coverage area of one tower to that of another. Plus, they can spot activity in Mexico when groups might be staging a border incursion. Anduril Industries' ghost drones even gather data from the company's artificial intelligence system, which is called Lattice. At short distances, the ghosts are almost completely silent. A Customs and Border Protection endorsement on Anduril Industries' website describes Lattice as eyes in the back of my head. One border agent explained, once it integrates with a few pieces of technology, it will be completely different than what we've done in the past. Several Customs and Border Protection documents say Anduril Industries is obligated to provide a software development kit and an application programming interface API at the government's request. According to a procurement document, Customs and Border Protection wants technical data for the Lattice system so that the agency will be able to install and incorporate new sensor feeds into the Lattice tower, utilizing existing services and/or infrastructure. A Customs and Border Protection statement of work specifies that any human image labeling has to be done in the United States and that faces must be blurred before labeling. The same document allows for a vendor to store non-blurred images for training purposes. Vendors are also authorized to use images to train artificial intelligence. According to Jack Paulson, a former Google research scientist who now runs the Technology Inquiry Watchdog Group, Customs and Border Protection could potentially use the Application Programming Interface, API, to go around Anduril Industries' software and gather data and images themselves. Jack Paulson said in an interview with Shadowproof, "The blurring process could easily be circumvented if one of the application programming interface functions involved sampling from the raw surveillance feed." Customs and Border Protection is authorized to provide data to Department of Homeland Security's agency-wide biometric data management system, also known as HART. HART stands for Homeland Advanced Recognition Technology. Data stored in HART includes fingerprints and facial images, which can be used by the Agency for Facial Recognition. Advanced surveillance systems have been attempted at the border before under industries, most notably the Boeing-developed Secure Border Initiative. SBINet project combines sensors and surveillance towers with the aim of reducing illegal immigration. The US government spent $1 billion on the system, which was riddled with bugs, before it was quietly scrapped back in 2011. Although the Boeing-developed Secure Border Initiative SBINet failed, experts on migration say that it did have an impact, and it's likely SBINet contributed to a spike in deaths among migrants trying to cross the border by pushing crossers into more deadly terrain. Driving migrants into rugged territory is a strategy the US government has employed for decades. US Immigration and Naturalization Services, INS, a forerunner of Department of Homeland Security, launched a prevention through deterrence strategy back in 1994. One aspect of the strategy was to push migrants from crossing at safe urban nodes of the border, like El Paso and San Diego, towards rougher terrain. Doris Meissner, then the INS commissioner, believed that under prevention through deterrence, geography would be an ally and that migrants would soon quit trying to make the crossing once they saw how deadly it had become. It became common for the crossing to take days. Migrants often ran out of water and food partway through the trip and were sometimes relieved to be detained by the time Border Patrol caught up with them. A study published in the Journal of Borderland Studies used methods from archaeology and military science to measure how energy is expended by people crossing the border between the United States and Mexico. The study then compared those results to records showing the locations of migrant deaths. Researchers found relationships between the enforcement, specifically in the form of SBINet, routes taken by border crossers and fatalities. Avoiding areas where they would likely be intercepted or surveyed often sent migrants into regions where they were more likely to encounter dehydration, hypothermia, injury, and exhaustion. In a 2013 interview, one Border Patrol agent described migrants avoiding the SBINet system. The agent said, "They'd stayed down in the mountains where it blocked the camera." That was the second part of Will Lennon's article, U.S. Customs and Border Protection Plans Vast Expansion of Technology-Based Surveillance. Tune in tomorrow for the third and concluding part of this series. Until then, goodbye and God bless.